This week, the Dow and the S&P closed at the highest points in U.S. history. Welcome, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek. It's a pleasure to be back with you this weekend with another Muy Grande size show. We have two more discussions with top industry insiders, plus the market headlines and news affecting your portfolio. One more hour of edutainment lined up for you. The discussion begins this week with Dr. Ron Paul's latest article. He talks about how the Swiss are taking a vote on returning their sovereign gold. John Embry, my first guest, says gold is integral to personal freedom, and yet the antithesis of the greenback granting the holder financial protection. India and China consume over 70% of global gold output each year. If just those two nations are absorbing most of the world's gold, what will happen to the price when the rest of the world recognizes the opportunity? Investment capital flows into equities and bonds are excessive, creating a contrarian opportunity to accumulate gold at fire sale prices, according to John Embry. Next up, the Magambo, Richard Doughty, says trillions of dollars of pension fund capital is destined for the precious metals markets. China is encouraging international gold investment to the delight of precious metals investors. And every wise individual desires a gold-backed currency, but few, if any, legislators have the intestinal fortitude to risk the backlash. And then Robert Ian kicks another field goal with his latest editorial. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather report. Cloudy skies appeared over the gold market this week amid extreme U.S. dollar strength on news that the Federal Reserve intends to increase interest rates a bit sooner than expected following the FOMC meeting this week. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX Exchange, gold was only off, though, $1,460 for the week, finishing around $1,216, about 1%. Silver gave back 83 cents, ending at $1,779 an ounce. Gold and silver equities index dropped about 5%, down around 5 points, while palladium gave back 25, finishing near $812, still suffering from the Ukraine-Russia ceasefire. Platinum was hit hard, off about $40, finishing at $1,370 an ounce, and West Texas Intermediate crude oil declined around 38 cents, ending at $91.77 a barrel. Well, this week, Fed governors cut monthly bond buying by about another $10 billion, just as expected. It's down to $15 billion per month now in stimulus, while holding rates near zero until next year. The Federal Open Market Committee suggested that the quantitative easing program could be wrapped up as soon as the next meeting. This was the seventh rate cut since last November from a peak of $85 billion per month in quantitative easing. The news catapulted the U.S. dollar higher, which posted its 10th consecutive winning week amid better-than-expected unemployment figures as well. Moreover, comments from the Fed indicated that borrowing costs could climb more rapidly than anticipated. On Thursday, news from the Labor Department indicated that the number of Americans filing for new unemployment claims fell more than expected, a robust economic indicator. Turning to geopolitical news, European stocks climbed on reports that voters rejected the bid for Scotland's independence. British unity is viewed as a market positive, however, reducing the safe haven premium somewhat, at least in the near term. On a positive note, physical demand in Asia gained some steam amid price discounts. Premiums over the London spot rate in China were about $5 to $6 an ounce, marginally higher than recent figures. Bottom line on the precious metals. Well, the market does appear to be setting up for this final bear capitulation that has been on the table now for at least the last 12 months during the long sideways consolidation. For next week's stock picks and all the forecasts, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter. We had at least two very solid picks this week, one of which just blew higher along with the stock market. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility was virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange. Investors viewed the solid employment figures as market-friendly. More jobs translates into fatter consumer wallets, increased spending, stronger corporate profits, and share prices. The bulls on Wall Street have been running for 5 years, the second longest bull market in the last 100 years, with no signs of abating. In addition, the Federal Reserve pledged to hold benchmark lending rates close to zero into next year, presenting a near-perfect world scenario for investors, strong corporate profits combined with ample liquidity. The S&P 500 and the Dow Industrials rose to all-time highs while the greenback posted its longest rally in nearly half a century. For the week, the Dow added 292, around 1.7%, blasting above the 17,000 level, closing at 17,279. Now en route to my 18,500 forecast posted nearly 2 years ago. The S&P 500 finished at up 24 around 2010, about 1.25% higher for the week, while the NASDAQ added 12 points, finishing at 45.79 with an earshot of a new high. The big news on Wall Street this week, other than the FOMC, the much-anticipated IPO of Alibaba Group Holdings Limited. Ticker symbol BABA, B-A-B-A, shares priced at $68 but blasted higher at the open of trading to around $92 and quickly ran within 10 minutes to within pennies of $100 a share. However, after that point, the trend abruptly shifted, as so often is the case with first-day trading. Short selling, though, is not allowed. Shares found support and steadily increased into the close, recording a first-day gain of nearly 40%. The Chinese e-commerce giant began trading around midday on the New York Stock Exchange, a close of around $93.89 a share, the uppermost point in its forecast range. The deal raised about $22 billion, making it the largest U.S.-listed IPO to date, topping even Google and Facebook. And the technical take here in the near term on one day indicates, from my perspective, further selling as soon as Monday. So I cannot suggest that anyone with a trading mentality run out and buy shares just yet. Well, as I've noted over the last decade on this show nearly, solid IPO market almost always a good indication of strong bullish conditions. Plus, our 7-component fear index did something you really don't always see. It's not very common. It fell into the deeply fearful category, just as prices blew to the highest level in American history. From my perspective, and I think from most contrarians, this is a wildly bullish sign, at least for the next week or two. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Richard Doughty, a.k.a. the Magambo Guru, plus John Embry from Sprott Asset Management. Don't forget, Robert Ian wraps up the show, so we'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek.com radio. Well, we're so happy that you chose GoldSeek.com radio as a trusted investing and business news source. Today's special guest, Mr. John Embry from Sprott Asset Management. Well, John Embry, an industry expert in precious metals, researched gold sector for over 30 years, a portfolio manager since 1963, senior advisor at Sprott Asset Management, GoldSeek Radio's favorite. Welcome back, John Embry.
Well, it's great to be here as always, Chris.
Interesting article this week from Dr. Ron Paul, you know, another big supporter and friend of our show here. Notes that voters in Switzerland are heading to the polls for a referendum on gold, and there's going to be a ballot to prohibit the Swiss National Bank from further gold sales. In other words, the everyday individual is starting to wake up and say, you know what, it's not a good idea if you take our sovereign wealth that our families have built up as a nation and, you know, loan it out to people and who knows where it goes and who owns what. Tell us why you think Dr. Paul might be onto something here, please.
Well, I think the referendum is maybe even wider than that. I think there's some suggestion that also included is the idea that they're going to repatriate what gold there is that's held outside the country that belongs to the Swiss, which again would put the cat amongst the pigeons because, I mean, we all know that any of this gold that has been farmed out to secondary custodians has probably been leased out and doesn't exist. So I'm very hopeful that the Swiss people are finally going to realize that their central bank has been doing them dirt in the gold space. I mean, one of the things about Switzerland, they were always very rigorous about this stuff. And suddenly, sort of as the gold wars heated up a few years ago, they sold a significant proportion of their gold. And there's some suggestion that the stuff that they still held has been leased. So I think this is a very positive development that they're going to get let the public vote on this and have a say rather than the Swiss National Bank, which is just basically working for the international cartel.
You know, I think everyone should keep an eye on their activities, particularly when it comes to finance, economics. Quick anecdotes about the nation. You know, they've managed to stay out of the middle of a couple of really unsavory wars in the last century. We've learned over the years that the Swiss actually have a couple of interesting things. They like to stay out of foreign entanglements, which is interesting because that's what we used to do here in this continent as well. They actually have all the tunnels, the train tunnels and highways that enter or leave their nation. This may sound extreme, but are actually wired with explosives. China and Russia, the train tracks that go to and from China and Russia at the borders, they actually have different sized rails. So they have to change the trains actually over into completely different wheel sizes. And this, of course, is what they've learned over the years, that, you know, you have to be a little wary from time to time with what's going on with commerce and wealth leaving and entering one's nation.
But no, I think that one of the things that people should think something about are the smaller communities, Switzerland, Norway, Uruguay. They're probably running the most successful countries today. And this international movement to make things bigger and integrate things, I think, is breaking down. I have great respect for the Swiss. And I think what we're going to see here in the next couple of days is this Scottish election to see whether they will leave the UK. The UK is petrified this is going to happen, because I think this is going to would seriously impact the City of London. And it's going to be fascinating to see whether they can coerce the Scottish into sort of staying in the Union. If I were a Scot, I would leave.
You know, I just haven't done my due diligence. You know, this would be like a portion of Canada or the United States, maybe New England and the United States saying, you know, we've been waiting for this for about 1,000 years or at least 500 years, and it's time to say our goodbyes. I mean, what an interesting thing. And one wonders about the economic ramifications for both countries. Do you have any comments?
The economic ramifications are serious. The Scots are only, I think, 6 million people, but they have about a third of the land mass. But more importantly, they have an oil off the coast of Aberdeen and what have you. This would be a huge blow to England. Huge blow.
Well, that's food for cogitation. I wonder if we might also address some other geopolitical issues that we've seen. And I know that you've been monitoring the temporary ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine. Almost every one of our guests has had their own unique perspective on the potential that could come from this situation, that it might even be perhaps the spark of something larger and another good reason to have some portfolio insurance, i.e., sound money in one's portfolio. Although we have a temporary ceasefire, at least as of last week, think of the strategic significance here. We have Ukraine areas known as one of the breadbaskets of all of Europe, or at least Eurasia. And then you also have the natural gas and the pipelines running from Russia through there. And there's even the electrical lines that give power to much of Europe other than France. Can you tell us what your thoughts here on the significance?
I just read a long piece and of all publications, Foreign Affairs. It was written by a U.S. professor in the States. And he had the most even-handed view on this. I mean, clearly, the U.S. and NATO have been pursuing this to the extent that they really alienated Russia. Like, Russia is being demonized, and I don't think they're the real problem here. I think the problem lies more with the West. Russia is attempting to protect its territorial integrity. And as a result, I think they're almost being lured into a fight, but Putin's too smart. He's not going to get into a fight. Now, all of this geopolitical stuff that's going on, I find extremely unsettling, because it's coming against a backdrop of extreme difficulty in both the financial and the economic spheres.
Right.
You begin to wonder whether that's the reason it's being done, is sort of to sort of deflect attention from this, from these problems in the real world.
Oh, the Hegelian dialectic at work. problem, reaction, solution.
Yeah, that exactly. It troubles me because, you know, we can't have a third world war. I mean, that this is just out of the question because there's just too much nuclear armament that's in the world.
You're looking at the chessboard. You're three or four moves ahead of the mainline media. It's that perspective that we really need as investors, isn't it? Nowadays, it's just not enough to read the headlines, and we need the minutiae in order to prepare. If we are looking at another Archduke Ferdinand-style moment, Lusitania, are you implying here that perhaps it could be Ukraine?
Well, it could be. I would prefer not to believe that. I think there's just too many armaments in the world today. We can't let it come to that.
Exactly, because, you know, as famous physicists said, the Fourth World War would be fought most likely with sticks and stones.
Oh, that was the great line of Einstein's, and it's absolutely true.
You know, we also have incredible U.S. dollar strength. But, you know, in the final analysis, I think if you look at the big technical picture, the dollar has been stuck in a trading range for going on 4 years. Every time it reaches the top of that range, it just seems to fall right back down. But it certainly has implications for the metals. Any thoughts?
I mean, obviously the dollar is the antithesis of gold and silver. And the people in the United States, the authorities, are desperate to keep the dollar sort of elevated. They're lying about the economic reality, and I think they're interfering with markets to sort of make things look better than they are. And as a result, gold and silver have been sort of marginalized. And what they've created is an incredible buying opportunity in both metals.
Another key component in this precious metal story, we see the Federal Reserve last week still holding rates steady while the ECB has taken even further steps towards liquidity, a dovish stance there by taking rates even further negative. This is something I don't think we've ever seen before, have we? I mean, have we seen central banks actually take their benchmark lending rates into negative territory?
Well, I think it tells you, Chris, exactly how serious this problem is. I mean, basically, there's infinitely too much debt in the world. There's massive numbers of derivatives. And the combination of both these things are going to bring the banking system down if interest rates were to rise. So they're going to do everything to try to prevent that.
Another takeaway point, I mean, we have China and India together consuming nearly 3/4 of the total gold output each year, over 1,000 metric tons with China, and not too far from that with India as well. This is quite an interesting situation because if just two countries alone are purchasing most of the world's output, what happens when the rest of the industrialized world? What about the BRIC nation? We have Brazil, and we also have Russia, which has a strong interest in the yellow metal, plus South Africa, which is a major producer. That's just four or five nations, and the rest of the world is likely to increase demand for gold as inflation becomes more evident. Wouldn't you agree?
This is what's going to break the whole gold market wide open, Chris. I mean, right now, the buyers are just hanging in the weeds and buying it after the paper market drives the price lower. Some point, this whole thing's going to change. There's going to be an enormous demand for physical gold. And that's when the physical market takes over. And as a result, the price is going to go berserk. What we're debating isn't whether it's going to happen. It's when it's going to happen.
That's still the wild card because they have their bazookas, if you will, their central banking bazookas pointed right at the gold market because they know, as you say, the antithesis. It is anathema.
It's their worst nightmare. And I mean, if the gold and silver market really traded where they should be trading, interest rates in the world would rise by several hundred basis points, the debt load would collapse, the derivative bomb would be set off, and the world would be totally different.
Would you like to share any contact information or let folks know more about Sprott Asset Management?
Come to www.sprott.com, and we've got lots of interesting stuff on the website.
Very good. Mr. Embry, we appreciate your help, and thanks so much.
My pleasure all the time, Chris.
Richard Doughty publishes the Magambo Guru economic newsletter in the sunny state of Florida. Welcome back, Richard.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. It's wonderful to be here.
We've seen this U.S. dollar, a revival recently, still, though, trapped within a trading range for a number of years as investors try to figure out, is the Fed serious about this hawkish talk? And what exactly will that mean for the markets? Gold is the antithesis of the U.S. dollar, as John Embry says on this week's show. So tell me what you think about this dollar strength. Is this a temporary phenomenon, or is it something that we're going to have to contend with for some time?
You know, there's just so many slimy shenanigans going on. There's just so much money at stake that, I mean, it involves governments right up from the central bank to the top. This thing has big repercussions as to trade balances and whatnot, and how many trillions of dollars of U.S. debt they're sitting on, which would be adversely affected by a dollar that's doing bad things. And so who knows, Chris? They're going to do everything they can to keep it going. That's all I know.
If our officials really took the time to think about the reverberations that could come from these manipulations, because in the models, sure, it works great. You know, you've got your x-axis and your y-axis and your demand curve and your supply curve. Everything remains equal. In the real world, as I alluded to, the reverberations can be devastating. They don't always come right away. Sometimes, you know, the butterfly flaps its wings in New Guinea, and it takes a little while for chaos theory to bring the hurricane or the tornado to North America. But we know the cogs are in motion, aren't they?
Well, you know, it's funny you should mention that butterfly flapping its wings thing, because that made a big impact on me when I first came across it. That's exactly right. This little butterfly effect is like a domino effect, but the dominoes keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So they have to keep this thing going. Everybody's money is in the stock market. You know, they somehow equated savings with investment, that they're being equal. And now everybody's money is in the stock market. There's no savings whatsoever. And a little bit of savings you think you have in the bank, that's swept into treasury instruments every night. So you're in the stock and the bond market. Everybody is, all their money. And so things are magnificent, gigantic repercussions, just like you said, when you're talking about all the money, all of it.
You're a student of the markets, and you have been for decades. When I hear the Magambo say everybody's on one side of the market, I get nervous.
You should get nervous. Well, that's one of the axioms of investing, is that the majority of investors have to be wrong and lose money so that a small minority of investors can make money. It's kind of a zero-sum game. It's actually less than a zero-sum game after you subtract all the commissions and fees and taxes and blah, blah, blah. So majority of investors have to be wrong. They're all in the stock and the bond markets. They all have to be wrong, except for the few people out here like me and like you, I assume, pounding the table for gold and silver because it's the only real money. Everything else is going to go down the tubes pretty soon.
We're certainly sharing the same side of this Titanic economy, at least. But we also have to acknowledge the fact that it has been a challenging couple of years here for those of us in this camp. We want happy days to return. Give us an idea. Look into the crystal ball and let us know.
Well, a guy named Robbie Batra did that very same thing, and he looked at how things go in cycles, and the last cycle is the acquisition stage, and that's where we are, and everything collapses into ashes, and then you have chaos, and then you have order rising out of chaos and strongman governments, and so that's basically the way it's going to work out this time, too. It's all going to have to crash, and then we'll rebuild from the ashes like a phoenix rising from the ashes.
If I decipher the Magambo speak correctly, it's all inevitable. It's written in stone. The timing is a little more challenging.
That is a very pithy way of saying it. Congratulations. That is exactly right. These things are winding to their inevitable conclusion, which is going to be bad news for everybody. This is the same thing that governments have been doing for the last 2,500 years. They've been borrowing themselves into bankruptcy, and they can flail around with paper currencies all they want. The end result is inflation and ruin, inflation in prices, the revolt of the masses, and ruination of everything.
I wouldn't be as inclined to procure sound money if most of the pundits, most of the talking heads, most of the mainline media, most of the financial advisors were saying, well, you know, you need to have at least 15 to 25% of gold and silver investments or assets in your portfolio in the event of an unforeseen black swan 5 or 10 sigma event. Don't we? We have hurricanes, don't we? We have storm. Show me the guy that predicts them accurately every time. Okay, yes, we can see a hurricane coming for a couple of days. I know you keep your eye on that radar screen. We need a life raft. We need to have a bunker to protect us in the financial markets. They're a little more tricky, I think, than even the weather in most cases. And that's what I'm hearing from you. I'm hearing if everybody in the U.S. had a nice cushion, a nice 10 or 20% of their nest egg, you know, locked up safely, we'd be fine. But we don't, and not even pension funds. The pension funds have less than 0.5% invested in the precious metals. Think of what's going to happen when even a pittance of that rolls into it. I'd like your thoughts.
It's funny because pension funds are, we're talking, $7-12 trillion, and all the gold in the world is not worth $1 trillion.
Well, you know what the irony of that is, though? It's going to be worth $7-10 trillion one day, isn't it? Or more.
Yes, it is. That's the lesson of history. That's what I find so perplexing. It's right there in every history book, basically, what happened at the end of this thing, and people with silver and gold did very, very well, and everybody else did not.
You make it sound so simple. Let's keep going with this. Keep the ball rolling, because there's a lot of interesting topicality here. We haven't even talked about the geopolitical issues on the table. This drama that's breaking out, although we've had a temporary ceasefire, but between Russia and Ukraine, I bring it up in front of every guest, and it looks to me like this is going to be a hot button. This is going to be the next hot spot on the radar screen, you know, and it is a strategically significant focal point because it's where West meets Russia. And you remember the last time around, that was the Cold War. Let us know what you think.
I think that it all has to do with the money. If it wasn't for people owing so much money, they wouldn't be resorting to these drastic measures. Well, what did the first thing Russia do? They cut off the gas to Ukraine. I mean, that's saving money. Where's my money? Show me the money. There's just so much money owed that can't be paid back. The only thing you can do is just knock them out. And so that's what this whole thing is all about. It's all about the money. They owe so much, and they got to get it somehow, and they got to find a way not to pay somehow. And that's exactly what happens every time. The government resorts to a war to give them an excuse to do a lot of government spending, and they tell the people to be patriotic and pony up their money for some bonds, and everybody has a wonderful time. If everybody's sitting around there fat and sassy, and they got no problems at all about money, and are watching game shows on TV, they're not going to be rioting and taking over other countries. No, these people are desperate.
Well, you know, we do see some desperation, don't we? Because we're seeing the ministers at the European Union drop interest rates to the lowest level of any central bank that I can find in history. In fact, one of their benchmark lending rates now, their key rates, is under zero. How do you lend at under zero? Let me have your money, and why don't you just give me a little bit of it for the opportunity of handing me your money?
It is preposterous, and it's obviously doomed to failure. But the most exciting thing recently is the article that appeared in the account by the Council of Foreign Relations, who is a big shot bunch of shadowy guys who do all kinds of, got all kinds of power and whatnot, and they're recommending giving money to people directly, just giving money to people, and that's changing the dynamic. Right now, the dropping interest rates benefits the supply side. Manufacturers and whatnot are supposed to gear up and sell to people that don't have any money. Oh, it's obviously not working. We're up to our ears in debt. So nobody's going to be borrowing money to start a new plant and equipment. But if you give money to people to just spend, now you switch to the supply side. And suddenly, I think it's significant that that article came out from the Council on Foreign Relations. It's really kind of spooking me out. And so where to invest? Well, that money's got to go somewhere. So they're going to have something where they're going to get money into the hands of people who will spend it. Remember those tax rebates? We had a tax rebate one. Well, how about that now? Or just actually show up at the bank and they give you a couple of packets of $100 bills. It's basically what we're going to boil down to. I think what basically they're trying now is we're hiring a lot of people to run, to sign people up for welfare, and a lot of people are getting on welfare, so that's pumping a lot of money into the economy. And I think that's the way the government is attacking it so far. A lot of people are getting welfare and disability benefits.
Frederick the Great of Prussia would echo your thoughts right now. You know, that's what this reminds me of. You might recall his saying, all strategy goes out the window as soon as the first shots are fired. This is what we kind of opened the discussion, the dialogue with today. This concept of the models work great on paper until the first shots are fired.
Until the first contact with the enemy, and suddenly we're in big trouble.
Okay, so where does this lead? Now, we know that we have this nascent recovery, as they're calling it. I mean, apparently folks are back at work. Of course, most of the numbers that I'm seeing behind the scenes seem to indicate people are kind of tossing up their hands and saying, you know what, I give up trying to find meaningful employment. People seem to be despondent, though. But, you know, our officials want us to think that.
The government always says things are wonderful. That's what they do. They don't want to go around telling people, hey, we're doing a bad job here, and so you ought to be panicking in the street. No, they're going to try to calm you down. They got an election coming up. I mean, they got problems. They don't want to be rocking any boats. So, everything's going to be just fine, no matter how much they have to lie about it, no matter how many statistics they have to torture, no matter how many complete fabrications that actually come out of nowhere.
If you're not along with the party mantra, you threaten confidence. I love this word, confidence. What is this fear of rattling confidence? A robust, strong, solid economy, hardworking, you know, results-oriented, productive workforce doesn't need to be confident. I mean, it's part of the equation. It's already in the function. If you're in a Ponzi scheme, what happens when the Ponzi scheme, people start to wake up and lose confidence in the scheme, the whole thing implodes.
Yeah, that's why they're so dramatic in their response to anybody that's telling the truth about anything. What is it? George Orwell said that the first casualty is truth. But they have to keep this thing going. As soon as confidence goes and things start going downhill, it can spiral out of control. And we're talking everybody's money, all of it. You know, it's not like you have any savings at home anymore. If you might even have $100 under your mattress there, well, adult buying power of that $100 isn't going anywhere. I'm telling you, that's going to be depreciated along with everything else. You're just going to have a little pile of paper at the end. There's no way to get around this thing except to buy gold and silver, which is the history of the ages. That it's infallible, it's guaranteed, it has never failed. No government scheme has ever worked. All the governments have got into this situation sooner or later, and these schemes have never, ever worked. And I don't think it's going to work again this.
Exactly. And, you know, George Bernard Shaw, since we're on to quotes, echoed Oscar Wilde's sentiments when he said, if you're going to tell people the truth, you better make them laugh. Otherwise, all right, well, so where are we now? We're looking at the markets, we're back at the metals markets, and I guess you can look at it from two perspectives. You can say this cup is half empty or the other way around. And it was time for the herd to stop, graze a bit, refresh, you know, catch their breath before the next big stampede. Give us an idea when you think that's going to come to pass.
Is completely full. This is the best time to buy metals you ever saw. The government just got through having a case dismissed from court because the plaintiffs had no standing about manipulating the gold and silver market. The government argued it is perfectly legal under the Exchange Stabilization Act to manipulate any market, and yes, they're manipulating the gold and silver markets, but it's perfectly legal, so they don't have a case against it. There's a lot of people out there that don't care about what happens in the United States. They care about what's happening in their country.
Isn't that a key takeaway point? Because we just read this week that China has opened up its market for the first time fully here for gold and silver investing. They open up their market to foreigners. That's direct access for investors into their new markets. As you may know, China's Shanghai market actually delivers something like 7 to 10 times more gold than the Globex or the Comex, which I think is a remarkable thing because the Shanghai market is a tiny fraction of a market, but they're doing what a market is supposed to do. In Shanghai, they recognize people might just want want their gold. People buy and sell.
If you were China, you had a 3,000-year history with gold. You understand the significance of gold, as should we, since it is written into our Constitution that money shall only be silver and gold. But they do, and they got a lot of dollars. And what do they do with that dollar? Why not manipulate the COMEX, which keeps the price down, so they keep buying a lot of gold through Shanghai and Singapore and Hong Kong and who knows where else, gold at these depressed prices. It would be a big coup for them because they want a gold-backed currency. Everybody does. Everybody wants one. Nobody is willing to pay the price of having one, which is you can't reward your friends with lucrative government money.
If that's not cuisine for cogitation.
Cuisine for cogitation, alliterative and everything. I am very impressed with you, Chris.
That's a great place, I think, to wrap up today's discussion. Tell us any contact information you'd like for folks so they can find out more about Richard Daughtey's work as AKA the Mogambo.
Well, a guy named Doug has a website called MogamboGuru.com. Probably is the one I write every once in a while, but I don't write much anymore. But it can be found there. And other people are very nice about posting it on their websites, including Goldseek. And
it's always fun chatting with you. We're going to look forward to having you back on the show.
It's always wonderful being here with you, Chris. Thank you.
Today's featured guest on Goldseek Radio says the United States is bankrupt and flat broke. The U.S. is in fiscally worse shape, maybe even than Greece. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show Dr. Lawrence Kotlikoff, a professor of economics at Boston University and author of The Clash of the Generations, as well as the Inform Act, focused on improving the welfare of every American. Welcome back, Professor Kotlikoff.
Pleasure to be with you.
In your latest page-turner, Clash of the Generations, you and Scott Burns outline an interesting 60-year government Ponzi scheme here. You show that consumption has soared while savings have dwindled for the typical American. You know, this is a peculiar anomaly. How can consumption skyrocket while savings dwindle?
You have a certain amount of income, national income, and if you consume more of it, you're going to have, by definition, less saving and therefore less money to invest because your income is can either be spent or saved. Nothing else can happen with it. So that's true for a household. It's also true for a country. And over the last 60 years, the government's been taking ever more resources from younger people, including future generations, and giving them to older generations to consume. And each generation has taken its turn at this game of take as you go. And I'm talking about transfers, not just in the form of Social Security benefits, but also Medicare benefits, Medicaid benefits, tax cuts that differentially help the elderly, just tax cuts in general that leave, you know, larger official debts to the young. So, and it's also, there's been a shift in the tax structure away from taxing the income of owners of assets and towards taxing wages. Now, who's got assets? It's older people. And who's got wages? It's younger people. So there's all these things that have been going on in many different ways that have entailed an expropriation of the young by each successive generation of the old. And my generation, the baby boomers, are about to, you know, are standing in line to do this as well. Nobody's looking at the big picture, which is the magnitude of the burden of the bills for our children. Because most of the bills are off the books. Most of the bills we can't see because they've been labeled in a way to keep them off the books in accounting that would make Enron or Bernie Madoff blush. So, you know, you have enormous liabilities to pay for Social Security benefits, for Medicare benefits, Medicaid benefits, for defense spending. We have to, you know, pay for the government's military in the future. We've got all kinds of expenditures that we have to pay for, and we also have all kinds of taxes that are coming due, but the taxes as projected by the CBO are $205 trillion short of the revenues as projected by the CBO when you value everything in the present. So we've got a $205 trillion fiscal gap based on the CBO's Congressional Budget Office's own projections released last October. The official debt's only $12 trillion. So we're hiding almost all of the liabilities net of the taxes to cover those liabilities with this bookkeeping that we're doing and the failure to do fiscal gap and generational accounting, which the Inform Act would require. So, we're running a Ponzi scheme. Yeah, we're broke. We're probably in worse shape than Greece. Yeah, we're far worse shape than Detroit. Social Security by itself is in far worse shape than Detroit's pension system. And nobody's looking at that picture except some members, some brave members of Congress come along every so often and they start talking about it. And they might propose something and not get reelected. But this is generational theft, pure and simple. We always say that we love our children and we care the most about our children, but we seem to hate everybody else's children. We have to understand in this country that our children are everybody's children. In other words, your child is my child or my child is your child when it comes to the education system, when it comes to the healthcare system, when it comes to how much taxes we're going to leave the next generation. We're in this together. And we have to start seeing other people's children as our children. It's got to be our kids are us, not Toys R Us.
We have to think about the work environment that they'll be facing, because you covered healthcare, education, but we're seeing just an erosion in the quality of employment available to graduating students, whether it be high school, college, graduate school, underemployment, if you will. Any comments?
Yeah, no, it's horrible. I know so many college graduates who are doing jobs that it would be unheard of for a college grad to be doing if they can find any job whatsoever, if they're not employed for a year. So it's a really, people have gone to really excellent schools and paid a lot of money out of their own pocket or their parents' pocket. So we're suffering, we're facing very intense competition from folks across the oceans in different countries, not just China, but really we're competing with people all over the world in a way that wasn't the case because the internet makes it able to do business abroad, to import goods that are produced abroad at a cheaper price, or to hire engineering, computer software engineering, whatever, over abroad. But we also have competition with human automation via the form of smart machines. I say human automation because humans have developed the software code that is now being embedded in smart machines, which is replacing humans. And there's very few things you can think of, apart from maybe from massage you can get from a machine quite well. There are very few things you can think of that a machine can't do. It can shoot our enemies. It can take our purchases. It can, collect tolls on the highway. It can drive our cars shortly. It'll deliver our packages via drone or whatever. That's all coming. In the past, we had technological change, which didn't seem to be so substitutable for humans. But this form of robot technology, smart machine technology, seems to be able to directly compete with humans. So, yeah, the fact that we've got that, those two things on the plate, the fact that we're undereducating our children, we're not seriously investing in their education, we're wasting trillions on, or at least, probably at least over a trillion in wars that obviously are not winnable, that have been a total waste of money and lives and bodies. I mean, just a total disgrace to have spent 10 years in Iraq and then have that entire military fall apart in 10 minutes. Same thing's happening, probably will happen in Afghanistan. And think of all the young men and women who sacrificed their lives and bodies for a good cause, but it was poor leadership at the top for somebody's prestige. George Bush wanted to say he was a top military commander. Well, let him go fight and get maimed for life. He didn't do that with no real plan to win. It was a cat's cowardly thing to leave our kids in Afghanistan with no real plan to win. So, and this kind of cowardly behavior by older men who don't have their own kids or their own lives at stake, and we saw that in Vietnam. I think when we commit our military, we need to, and the cost of that military, human otherwise, material, we should know what we're doing and have a game plan for winning, or pull out as soon as we figure out we can't win.
You raise so many interesting points here. For instance, you talk about the replacement of jobs by smart technology, smartphones. We find it everywhere. There's smart washers, dryers, microwave ovens. I was in a friend's car the other day. Thing was talking and giving instructions. I mean, it's just a remarkable situation. But you're right. You know, it is replacing jobs. Maybe you could tell folks why this is different from the classical John Henry, the hammer in his hand versus the railroad pneumatic drill there. Why is it different this time? I mean, could there really be a revolution of machines and robotics and smart technologies that causes an employment vacuum?
You know, it may be the combination of the technology coming on board and other products not coming on board that people can actually that need a lot of people or that don't have a lot of competition to make those products. So, you know, we've had a lot of technological improvement in agriculture, and it led to an enormous reduction in the workforce in agriculture, but people were able to find other jobs, maybe because they weren't competing with so many people from abroad. In effect, the transportation costs and the communication costs have come down so much. But also, you know, if you think about the horse and buggy that gave way to the car, to the, think about a taxi back when we had horses and carriages. There was a driver and the horses, right, and the buggy. And that was, okay, then the taxi comes along, the car comes along, there's still a driver, different means of transportation, but there's still a driver. Now we're going to have a driverless car. So we're going to have driverless taxis. That's going to put all the taxi cab drivers and all the Euler, whatever it's called, drivers out of business. Can't say that we didn't have smarter machines back in 1880 when, you know, we got put in a, or when we developed the railroad, when that first was invented, that that wasn't a, in effect, a smart machine that was going to take away a lot of jobs. It did, but other things came along. We now have, you know, you kind of think about if machines can do everything, what can people do that the machines can't do except hold hands?
You're right. Many of those jobs were lost in the horse and buggy, and the buggy whip, I think, is a classic example. But, you know, it did spark an industrial revolution. Are we going to have a society filled with programmers that program and maintain machines?
Because I'm actively doing research on this where, you know, we economists try and write down models and then not just static, but we look at what happens through time. And one of the things that happens is that when we introduce these smart machines, this technology, well, the programmers first get paid a whole lot because this technology can now be used and has a lot of uses so that they get a big return. But then when all that code gets embedded, you suddenly don't need so much programmers, as many programmers anymore. Because think about Big Blue, that computer that has become the best chess player in the world. It doesn't have to get any better to beat forever every human on the planet, whoever comes along. We don't need an even better Big Blue. We've already built it. It's there forever. And so the computer programmers will likely suffer a big drop in their wages in the future, but there'll be some hire just to maintain the code. But the old code is going to be competing with the new programmers. The other thing to say here is that when people don't have jobs, when younger people are put out of jobs or they're put into lower paying jobs, they can't save as much, so they can't accumulate the material wealth that they would otherwise have accumulated. So if you kind of model saving and investment and what we call capital formation in the context of this kind of generational problem arising from technological change, where the older people kind of reap the reward, the return to this investment in robots, and the younger people reap lower wages, well, the younger people aren't there to, in effect, buy the output of these machines, and through time, there's less material wealth in the economy, and people in the long run can actually end up better, worse off. Everybody can end up worse off in the simulations, even though the technology is better, because there's less material wealth that's been accumulated, less capital around for people to work with. And this has, so we can simulate this entire process of technological change, making everybody worse off through time, except the initial owners of the technology who benefit initial inventors. So, you know, the key question about the technology is, aren't these new cars terrific? They can drive themselves, blah, blah, blah. But the second question is, who's going to have any money to buy those cars if nobody has a job? And these are two very interconnected questions, and when we simulate the interconnection between those questions, you can end up with a society that's actually worse off on balance forever. So, you know, economists aren't called the dismal scientists for nothing. But it's very simple to get this kind of result. I wrote a paper with a professor at Columbia named Jeff Sachs. He's pretty well known, much more famous than me. Here's a paper that's on my website at kotlikoff.net that you can find under articles that shows the math of this happening and simulates it, and doing a more elaborate version of that with some other people, including Jeff.
I'll look forward to reading that article, and I hope our listeners will as well. Very interesting topic, but I'd like to shift over here to another topic you bring up in your latest book here, bestseller. You go on to note that the middle class has been eviscerated, and we're seeing signs of this, you know, almost everywhere. From the recent foreclosure deluge, which I think hit the middle class and working classes the hardest, as well as in EBT debit and food stamp card programs, 47 million participants. But perhaps nowhere else does it seem to be showing up than in real inflation-adjusted income levels. And we've already touched on that a bit, but Americans earn less on average than they did decades ago. You seem to have some idea of a solution here. What's it going to take to get people better paying jobs?
Well, we have to get our fiscal house in order so that we don't leave astronomical bills to our kids. That's going to take comprehensive health care reform, not having a Medicare system that's going broke, a Medicaid system that's going broke, Obamacare system is about to probably explode in costs when employers shut down, send their employees over to get Obamacare, and they realize that it's a lot cheaper to get it to pay a penalty, a small penalty, and not cover their workers. It's cheaper to ship them over to Obamacare and where they can get these subsidies. So Obamacare is likely to explode in costs. And then we've got employer-based health care, which the premiums for that are tax-free. So a larger and larger share of our compensation is not being hit by taxation because it's coming in the form of premium payments for these insurance policies, which is basically going into the pockets of the medical industry for procedures and medications that aren't making us any healthier than countries are spending a whole lot less on healthcare. So the Purple Health Plan, at the purpleplans.org, you can take a look. That is a plan for having a basic health insurance policy for every American, done in a way that won't drive us broke, that won't still entail private provision, that won't allow anybody to discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions. It's a very simple postcard-length fix, which a number of Nobel laureates have endorsed. There's a Social Security solution there, which involves freezing the existing system, which is 32% underfinanced and a complicated nightmare. I have a company called Maximize. I have a software company. We have a program called Maximize My Social Security, which I've had three engineers working on for years to get exactly correct all the details of the Social Security system. It's actually more complicated than the entire federal income tax, the Social Security system. So you need extremely smart software to figure out what to do with it. I write a column every week on the PBS NewsHour site about Social Security and answering questions, and just amazing. You could not make a system more complicated. You could have Russian bureaucrats could not come up with anything. We need to fix the tax system. There's this proposal there at the purpletax.org. But you also, there's another proposal I wrote up called the commonsensetax.org. So there we have to fix education. We have to, we're not spending enough on the teachers. The classroom sizes are too large. We have to come up, you know, use technology there to our advantage to get the best lectures remotely in front of every single kid in the country. because kids aren't getting a solid education, and we have to work hard on vocational training for the kids who want to move in that direction. You know, we have to follow some of the lead of what Germany and Switzerland are doing. They don't have the kind of unemployment problems. We should look at how they're educating people and how they're training kids, and we should just follow exactly what they're doing, because somehow they're getting it right in this day and age. The environmental, we need to have we're leaving a climate that has huge potential risks and costs to our kids, which we're facing up to. So we need to have a carbon tax and take the lead in keeping the world from going over a tipping point with respect to climate change and global warming. Nobody knows for sure what the deal is there, including the top scientists, but the top scientists all agree, well, virtually all of them agree, that we're close to a tipping point, and that things are getting, and we have to realize that this is, we're going to leave enormous bills, a climate that's extremely dangerous and hostile, and an undereducated next generation. Is that the American dream? And the wages of American workers today, apart from these fringe benefits, in real dollars are no higher on average, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, than they were in 1965. That right there is a statement about the end of the American dream. It's happened.
No, exactly. And I think you really hit on some important topics there. You know, modeling our education system on those which are working and those that are getting results. Take a look at China. You mentioned Germany and Switzerland. China, they're getting results. We are up against the world when it comes to education, and we've got to start preparing people with a little bit more, our students with a little bit more than just feel good, warm, fuzzy information. They need an arsenal, a toolkit to go to work. And you suggest that no brokerage account is safe. I found this article fascinating. You published at least two on the topic.
I'm writing a third one today, so it'll come out shortly. In the aftermath of the Madoff scandal and the failure of Madoff's brokerage account, the insurance entity called CIPIC, the Securities Investors Protection Corporation, which is basically a front for a bunch of Wall Street firms, they own and operate CIPIC. They were supposed to make good on their insurance commitments to all the Madoff victims. Well, there are a lot of Madoff victims. And if you multiply $500,000, which is kind of the amount that probably on average that CIPIC people lost, you know, far, far more than $500,000, which is what CIPIC was promising to pay. But for years, they had been collecting premiums from companies like Goldman Sachs of $150 a year for all the brokerage accounts that Goldman Sachs has, $150 a year from J.P. Morgan for all the thousands, whatever, hundreds of thousands of brokers. Yeah, $150. So they were running, CIPIC was running a scam itself, an insurance scam, telling everybody that there was this insurance. Then Madoff goes under. Then people turn and say to CIPIC, give us, you know, we've lost this amount of money. Some of it was beyond $500,000. Give us $500,000 that you promised. CIPIC turned around and said, they said to themselves, I'm sure, we don't have the money to cover this. So let's come up with some way to keep from paying. So what they came up with was the idea that if you had put money into the account and taken out over time more than you'd put in, which is, if you think about it, if I put in, let's say, $200,000 today and I let it grow, or maybe, you know, over the next 10 years, I put $20,000 a year, I save, okay? I save in a brokerage account, and I let it grow. Maybe I'm now, I do this when I'm in my 30s. Now I'm in my 70s, I'm retiring. I've got an account that can be quite large because of compound interest. And that's really what we invest for, to be able to take out more than we put in, right? Why else would we invest? So we take out our money, we spend it, okay? We now face two things from CIPIC. When we go and ask for the five, maybe we take out, you know, a third of our money and we leave the rest in there. So basically all our retirement savings is left in that account. It goes under. CIPIC can't cover. CIPIC declares it to be a Ponzi scheme, which they can do with really any fraud, any brokerage account that goes under, they can claim it was a Ponzi scheme. It's pretty easy to do that because there's no clear definition of a Ponzi scheme. You can even argue that the Madoff was not a Ponzi scheme based on its overall operations. But they call anyway, so they can declare it a Ponzi scheme. If you took out, if a third of your money that you took out exceeded what you put in, which it should over a long period of time, you're a net winner, according to SIPC, and therefore you're not owed a penny on the $500,000 of insurance. So you might have lost, you know, $1 million, $2 million. And because you took out more than you put in, you get back not a penny. But the story gets actually worse than that. Whatever you took out in the prior 6 years, because if your brokerage is located in New York, headquartered in New York City, or New York State, sorry, you're subject to New York State law, according to SIPC. So according to New York State law, SIPC can go after you for every dollar that you took out over the prior 6 years before the fraud was discovered, and sue you for that to the extent that that amount is less than your total withdrawals over your entire course of you over the 40 years that you had put the money in net of any contributions you put in. So if you, well, let me give you an example here. If you put in, you know, $200,000 four or five decades ago, and it grew to maybe $3 million, which is, could easily happen, given compounding and historic rates of return on the stock market, you thought that money was safe. You took out the money. Maybe you took out $1 million, and so you're viewed as a net winner to the tune of $800,000. Your brokerage account goes under. You had your statement after you'd taken out, you know, what this money. Your statement read that you still had $1.5 million as a balance. Well, you go and ask for $500,000 to cover the $1.5 million loss. You get nothing. Furthermore, since you've taken out $1 million over the past 6 years, they can sue you for $800,000. They can sue you for all your withdrawals over the past 6 years, up to what's called the difference between what you put in over the lifetime of the account and what you took out, which from my assumption here was $800,000. So they can sue you for up to $800,000. So you won't get paid the insurance that they promised you. And you'll also get turned around and get sued for $800,000. So you've lost your entire retirement savings. And now they're suing you to take your house or your vacation home. This is not insurance. This is risk generation. This is an insurance scam, which is putting everybody who has a brokerage account in the entire country at risk. If you take any money, if you do what every investor hopes, which is to make more money than you put in, take it out and spend it, you can't sleep at night for the next 6 years. Because if you spend that money and it turns out that within 6 years, some fraud is declared in that brokerage account, in that brokerage firm, it doesn't have to be, you know, connected to your specific account or your specific broker, just has to be the brokerage firm goes under because maybe the broker down the hall in that company was the bad apple. Anyway, SIPC can come and sue you back for every dollar you took out and spent over the last 6 years. So this is why I wrote a column called Close Your Brokerage Account, and because it's not safe. It's just, I wouldn't put a penny in a brokerage account at this point. There is a bill in front of Congress which would fix this problem, and I discussed that in the columns that I wrote. And we need to get anybody who's got a brokerage account today is not safe. They should take their money out, not spend it for 6 years to be perfectly safe. And then they can have the opportunity to spend it without risk of being clawed back by SIPC. You don't know who the brokerage is going to hire in the next 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, if you take your money out today. But over that entire time, if they you know, go under because of a fraud, you're liable for every penny you took out today of your account. So this is what SIPC has done to save Wall Street from paying its the claims that were rightfully should have been paid to the victims of the Madoff fraud. So we've all been made into Madoff victims, the entire population, by SIPC.
You know, it's almost reminiscent of what we saw there with Cyprus and, of course, the Polish pension scam, where they lost about half of their pension. I mean, there seems to be all this legislation behind the scenes that's putting those who used to be insulated from this type of threat of confiscation, if you will, and we can, for the most part, we're all on the hook now, is what it looks like. Do you agree?
It's not just the people who, you know, the Madoff victims were scammed twice by Madoff and now and then by SIPC, large numbers, and very few of them actually got any recovery from SIPC. The lawyer for SIPC, the lawyers there have been, you know, taking huge amounts of money as payment for their services. They should be doing their work pro bono. It's not just that, but they've changed the way that SIPC handled the Madoff case. Was they got the law changed in their favor to produce this definition of what they owe to and who has to repay money that was taken out. In effect, they call anybody who took money out in the 6 years before the fraud was discovered a thief. They're calling them a thief, and then they're going back and suing them for stealing money. That's what they're being accused of stealing money. It's double jeopardy. You could not only lose your entire retirement, you could not only not get paid your insurance, but then you get called a thief and get sued for a huge sum of money that you took out and you spent maybe on your mother's nursing home or your kid's education or you gave to charity. Now you're being sued for, in this example, $800,000, basically, or maybe it could be a smaller amount. It doesn't matter. So no brokerage account today is safe until we get this bill passed.
It sounds like we can't trust, as investors, our financial system, and you can't trust your brokerage account. Our currency is losing purchasing power, and the price of goods and services continue to skyrocket. Would you agree, then, that there's somewhere there must be an alternative investment class with some appeal against these corrosive powers, one of them obviously precious metals?
Well, I think precious metals are, you know, one way to try and hedge your bets, so I think everybody should have some precious metals in their portfolio. Whether you want to, you know, load up a huge fraction of your portfolio, I'm not sure I would advise that. There are other countries that you can invest in. For example, you could invest in the bonds of Chile, which is a very well-run economy, with led by a lot of economists in terms of the top cabinet positions. You could invest in the government bonds of New Zealand or Australia or Canada. These are countries that are all fiscally solvent. You can diversify holdings of stocks around the world, and you can try and do that outside of a brokerage account. You can try and do that with a mutual fund company that has a third party custody, where you're pretty darn sure that those securities that you've bought through your brokerage, through your mutual fund, actually are there. If you use, for example, Vanguard, and they invest, I think they probably use somebody like State Street Bank, which is solely as custodian company, then you're pretty well assured that the money's safe. Or you could just try and buy securities directly and hold the certificates. You know, in effect, put the money under your mattress, put the stock certificates or the bond certificates under your mattress and not use a broker, because you're suffering. You know, if you put money in a brokerage account, you cannot spend it for 6 years when you take it out, because it can all be clawed back. Every penny you took out can be clawed back net of whatever you put in. And we hope and pray that that's a big number when you invest. And the older you are, the longer you've invested in a brokerage account, the more at risk you are. And then for a given length of investment periods, the better your broker has done, the more you've accumulated in that account. And therefore, if you take your money out, the more risk you're going to face. So the people that everybody should be closing their brokerage account immediately, and the ones who have the most to worry about are the ones who've been in the longest in these brokerage accounts or have done the best in terms of rate of return.
Well, Professor Kotlikoff, we can't thank you enough today for just a very informative, enlightening discussion. You've given us so much food for thought. It's going to take us all, I'm sure, days, if not weeks, to digest all of this. We also appreciate the fact you may work around ivory towers, but you make time for the rest of us. So we wish you the best and continued success, sir.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and none of us are really in ivory towers. If we're really, economists are supposed to be trying to understand the world, and we better be in it to try to understand it. So I do, there are some economists who are in ivory towers, but most people are trying to really understand what's going on. So I think if economists were running our country, we wouldn't be in these kinds of problems. We have a government without a single PhD in economics, and Congress, as far as I understand, the people that are advising the Obama administration right now in economics, I've got no real credentials for doing this. I've got no top-level economists in the administration at this point. Anyway, great talking to you. We'll be in touch tomorrow, okay?